Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Claire Dieterer is a fine writer who spent her 20s having fun and hit her 30s with a lot of pain. Child rearing was terrifying. Expectations of perfection were so high they hurt. She found salvation on a yoga mat. Porny was her first thought when she struck her first pose. White people seeking transformation. Then she found some. This hour on Point, Claire Dieterer and her new memoir, Poser. You can join the conversation. Do you know the treadmill of new motherhood perfectionism? Would you do the downward dog to get off it? Have you? And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Claire Dieterer is an essayist and critic. Her work has appeared in Vogue, The Nation, The New York Times, Yoga Journal, much more. Of her new memoir, critic Danny Shapiro writes, "Yoga, let the eye-rolling begin," but then goes on to love the book. It's called Poser, My Life in 23 Yoga Poses. Claire Dieterer is slated to join us any moment here from San Francisco, California, but we're just right in the midst of all this. We've had a little trouble with the connection, so I'm going to give you a taste of Claire Dieterer's book. Again, it's called Poser, My Life in 23 Yoga Poses. You may have seen Judith Warner's column in the New York Times last weekend saying, you know, responding to a lot of what Claire is saying here, that in the 1970s, women wanted to take flight, get out of the kitchen, get out of the house, make new lives, kind of the liberation era. Now there's maybe a post-feminist era, a post-liberation era where people are, women are bound to the job and with responsibilities that come at home as well. Many of them looking inward, no small number through yoga. It's a multi-billion dollar industry trying to find that freedom that their mothers may have found by hitting the road, hitting the teepee, you call it. Here, I'm going to read a little bit from Claire Dieterer's new book, Poser, My Life in 23 Yoga Poses. And she's writing about her generation. She'd grown up in North Seattle, living in North Seattle. And here she is. Well, I may have her now. I'm told in my other ear. Claire Dieterer, are you with us?
Hi, Tom.
Hi. Claire, we've just given you a very handsome introduction.
Fulsome, I imagine.
Fulsome, no doubt. And you've missed it, but we've just been talking to ourselves here, to myself, with our listeners about your book, about Danny Shapiro saying, you know, yoga, let the eye rolling begin, but then going on to love the book, about what's some really fine writing in here, and this kind of intergenerational moment that you found yourself in, that's sort of riding underneath so much of your life in your 30s there in North Seattle. Suddenly you're out of your 20s, out of that kind of freedom. You've got kids. It's all happening. I was just vamping and just about to read, but maybe you'll read for us, Claire, if you'd be good enough, about this generation of what you call hollow-eyed women chasing virtue. Could you read just to get us started, Claire?
I'd be very happy to. We were a generation of hollow-eyed women chasing virtue. We, the mothers of North Seattle, were consumed with trying to do everything right. Breastfeeding was simply the first item in a long, abstruse to-do list. Cook organic food, buy expensive wooden toys, create an enriching home environment, attend parenting lectures, sleep with your child in your bed, ensure that your house was toxin-free, use cloth diapers, carry your child in a sling, make your own baby food, dress your child in organic fibers, join a baby group so your child could develop peer attachments, and don't quit your job, but be sure to agonize about it, and enjoy an active sex life, but only with your spouse. Also, don't forget to recycle. Those are some examples of some of the rules I was living with.
That's all you need. That's all that's required.
Yeah, just that.
That's all. That and nothing more. You write at some point in here about what being a kind of a combination of that you were responding to your mother's sort of 1970 mothering style, 1970s mothering style, if we can call that. Mm-hmm. So in response to that, you had become a 1950s housewife. What do you mean, Claire?
Well, as you said in your fulsome introduction, mm-hmm. I really had, of course, I'm 44, so I had grown up feeling like I could do anything and that I could have my life be whatever I wanted, and lived very free through my 20s, traveled the world, started my career as a writer. And I was really surprised when I became a mom at the just extensiveness of the rules that there were. And of course, they're not stated. There's sort of this subtle pressure.
And they're not exactly universal either. These are in your sort of, I don't know if Tony's the right word, but certainly not poverty-stricken Seattle suburb.
Yeah, privileged, liberal, organic, groovy, you know, sometimes I call it a bubble town, a bubble neighborhood. Mm-hmm. You know, there are Brooklyn, Berkeley, Seattle, North Seattle.
Park Slope, that sort of thing.
Park Slope, exactly. Mm-hmm. I think, in fact, Danny Shapiro made that comparison. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's definitely a homogenous group of moms with this set of rules.
So what are the rules? And what's going on with rules like these? I'll ask you that, but tell us the rules first for you. This was in the 1990s, I guess. You're out of those carefree 20s. You're having babies, and you're running into this monster ball of rules like what?
Well, first I want to say that I think that these rules are still very much in action. You know, I'm getting a lot of mail from young mothers now that this book has been published, and they all seem to feel that, or not the ones who write to me seem to feel like they're experiencing the same set of standards.
What, it's still got to be the breastfeeding, organic food, wooden toys, everything perfect at home, plus bring home the paycheck and make it all happen.
Absolutely. And, you know, not just breastfeeding, but sort of the breastfeeding on demand until you're, you know, certainly breastfeeding well into the time your child's old enough to thank you for it.
That is, to speak that sentence, thanks, Mom, mm-hmm. I'll have another.
Right. Exactly. Thanks, babe. Sort of this idea that you're supposed to be exquisitely responsive to your baby in every way, to sleep with it, to be available to it all times, even things like carrying your baby in a sling. I remember when my daughter was an infant, there was a idea that you oughtn't to put your baby in a stroller.
Because it was too far from the warm reassurance of your maternal corpus?
Of that old, yes, corpus/breast, let's face it.
Okay.
But also there was this crazy idea that the baby was supposed to sort of see things from the same perspective as you, which sounds insane.
Oh, those forward-facing, speaking of poses, those forward-facing smugglies or smugglies, as you call them.
I call them smugglies,
right?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, so there were those kinds of rules. They all had to do with the mother being exquisitely, extensively available to the baby.
What's that about? Why this sort of hyper organic, grass-fed perfectionism in mothers of your generation? Why? A particular set of mothers, okay, but why?
Well, to start with, I think it's a romanticization of cultures that are able to give that kind of care to their children, right? Who don't have to go to work in an office and make a living at a desk.
You're talking Samoan, I don't know. What culture is that?
I haven't really researched all that, but I think that that's sort of part of the propaganda or the ideology behind it.
Back to the earth, make it natural, make it pre-industrial, even.
Right. And so maybe there's a way in which it's a response to the kind of work that we do now. Mm-hmm. And also from the fact that people tend to live far away from their own parents, right? So they need a set of rules to latch on to because their mom's not there helping them out.
But in your case, the way your mom did it is exactly how you did not want to do it. And you sort of lay a generational judgment on her.
Yes, it's not so much a generational judgment as it is me trying to figure out why I responded so strongly to this set of standards. And, you know, I laughed at them as they were happening, and yet I felt their pressures on me very strongly. And I started to think, well, where does this come from? And as I said earlier, I think there's a lot of reasons that this set of rules has become so widespread within a certain class of women. But for me, one thing I started thinking about was a generational construct. I started thinking about my mom's experience. She, in 1973, she had two little kids, me and my brother, and she had done everything right according to the culture up to that point. She got married. She's a good wife, a good mom. She's a matron in sort of a leafy neighborhood in Seattle. And I think that all of a sudden the rules changed, the narrative changed. It wasn't about getting married and being secure. All of a sudden, the whole culture was sort of talking about finding yourself and being free and following your own path. And I think that for people who were childless, that was simple. But I'm really fascinated by this generation of women who sort of were on this sandbar between cultures where all of a sudden the rules changed and they're standing there, you know, with a holding in each, you know, by hand, a child, holding their children by the hand. And how do I do this with my kids?
Your path took you onto the yoga mat, and that was some journey in itself. And you've really sort of gone through the challenges here and your steps of figuring it out through a lot of fun and some real insight with yoga poses. We're going to look at that, Claire. I'm glad we got you on the horn, on the microphone there. It's really good to have you in San Francisco. Claire Dieter's new book is Poser, My Life in 23 Yoga Poses. We'll go out here a little bit with super guru, Shiva Ray. This is Yoga Trance Dance. Maybe get you in the mode for Claire Dieter's Poser, My Life in 23 Yoga Poses. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we will be right back.
In this meditation, you are dancing over anything that binds you. If you feel any stiffness or rigidity in your physical body, then as you move, liberate your creative freedom. Feel the power of your expression.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about life, marriage, babies, the search for perfection, and yoga with Claire Dieter, author of the new memoir of Figuring It Out in Your 30s. It's called Poser, My Life in 23 Yoga Poses. Shiva Ray really got me in the mood there, Claire. I don't know. I'm not a downward dog guy. Not yet, anyway, but might get me on the mat with that. It's a talk show, Claire. We've got callers, and I want to get straight to them and then to yoga. But first, from Nashville, Patra is calling. Patra, you're on the air with Claire Dieter. What's your story, Patra?
It feels like I'm listening to my life right now. although I'm 40, and I have my first child, and he's a little over a year old, and just like the writer, my mom raised me completely different from the way that I'm raising my son. And I am a stay-at-home mom, cloth diaper, breastfeeding, making the baby food, the wooden toys, all of that.
Do you feel this pressure to get everything just right? What's that about, Patra? Where's that come from?
I think with the way that I was raised, sometimes I think there were some things that were missing in my childhood that I would have desired. And so I think in raising my son, I feel like I am trying to give him the things that I didn't have. And because I do first of all, I'm completely in love with my child, by the way.
But of course, that's required, you know, too. You must be completely in love with the child.
Yeah. But, you know, just making sure, make sure that he is not missing out on anything. And then to even carry it a step further, you know, we're researching homeschooling now.
But the logical next step, right?
Right, the full Magilla. So does it make you, are you pulling it off, or do you feel miserable sometimes at the challenge of perfection?
You know what? I do honestly am a little bit unhappy, but in talking to other moms, it seems like the solution should be Mother's Day out. So he's 14 months, and he's been with me from day one the whole time. So I am considering doing Mother's Day out. And also, when I was pregnant, I was doing maternity yoga. And I, you know, it's so funny because I had actually forgotten about that. And I do remember the same as the writer, rolling my eyes at first when I signed up for the class. And I really actually enjoyed it. And you know, once I get the Mother's Day out going, I'm thinking I might just join a yoga class now.
Patra, you are right on the beam. I can't think of a sort of closer fit here with what Claire Dieter is writing about, the whole perfectionism and the sort of struggles that come with it and a little bit of pregnancy yoga thrown in there on the side. Wow, Claire, there it goes. Do you get this all the time now? Is everybody coming up to you and saying, that's me, that's the mom I was, or that's the mom I'm trying to be? And sometimes it drives me nuts.
I do get it all the time. And, you know, I think that Petra really hit it, saying that she's in love with her child. It's not that it's not a great experience being a mom. It's this sort of feeling that you're not quite living up to the standards, because who could, right? I mean, that's the very nature of them.
Especially so when it's not the 1950s anymore. A lot of people in this circumstance, they maybe almost joined at the hip with that beloved son or daughter, but many, many are working too.
That's exactly right. I think that's the X factor that a lot of people miss, is that we have this whole other huge pressure and necessity that our mothers didn't have. The other thing I wanted to respond to that she said was talking about her reaction to her experience with her own mother. I think one thing that was true for me was that my childhood, my mom ran off with a hippie 8 years her junior in 1973.
Never divorced your dad, because that would be, I don't know what, too conformist even to get divorced. Just run
right off
and live with Larry.
Well, they did get divorced last year.
Oh, okay.
In fact.
How many decades long?
Yeah, 38 years later, right. They got a divorce. Okay. So my mom went to a pig roast in 1973 and met this long-haired, literally love bead-wearing hippie and ran off with him. I mean, she took us kids, but we went off and lived on a sailboat and had all these crazy adventures. And in a lot of ways, it was a really great childhood. We had some really, really fun times. But I think that the introduction of that chaotic element into my childhood made me more uptight as a parent, made me want to keep things really stable for my kids.
They had love beads and pig roasts. You ended up with yoga. Why yoga?
Well, I mean, on the most basic level, because my back went out, right? That's why everybody
still breastfeeding
yoga.
That big baby at 10, 11 months it was, or something like that. Yeah.
I had this gigantic baby that I was supposed to be carrying in this sling and nursing until she was like 100 years old, and she was squashing me, and the next thing I knew, my back went out. So that really was how I came to it. You know, in my neighborhood where I lived, if your back goes out, people tell you to do yoga. Your doctor, the checkout guy at the grocery store, literally the homeless guy outside the grocery store selling the newspaper. They're all like, do yoga. Get a mat. It's going to make it better.
How'd that go?
So that was how I came
to it. You had this, what'd you call it, creamy, flushed, and covered with fuzz, this great, delicious peach of a daughter breastfeeding her through your back out. You went to yoga. What was your first reaction?
Well, you know, like many people, when I started yoga, my first reaction was sort of a combination of awe and awe, contempt, intimidation. Mm. You know, I perceived it as this incredibly smug activity, and yet it fit so perfectly with all the new rules I was supposed to follow, where I was supposed to be good all the time. What could be more virtuous than yoga, where you're not only doing your exercise, but you're literally holding your hands in prayer position while you do it? I mean, ideal, right?
I guess. I mean, I don't really know. Is that good? Is that running away from? Is that just Mother's Day out, as Patra said? I don't know. Is it good?
Well, I think that ultimately it was really good, and I think Mother's Day out is great. Mm-hmm. I think it's really important to have some time, if we're going to live with these really stringent standards and a lifestyle that, you know, we have to work, we do need some space. On the most basic level, I think that yoga, you know, gives you some rest and some space. I used to lie there on my mat and, you know, during the meditation portion and just think, I'm never going to have to clean this room.
Somebody else will dust it, or it'll be dusted by yoga mats.
Exactly.
Is that
alone was an upside.
Is that the hollow-eyed women part? What do you mean by hollow-eyed women? You're supposed to be, you know, I don't know, sparked with the glory of virtue and perfection. You're chasing virtue. Where did that leave you hollow-eyed?
Well, I think the problem with that sentence is the supposed to be part. I think that's the part that a lot of moms, working moms, older moms, I think that's the part that we feel really strongly, is that we're supposed to be something. And on top of being supposed to do all this stuff, right? I mean, it's hard work taking care of little kids and working on top of it. And on top of it, you're supposed to be, you know, euphoric. So I think that that's a lot of pressure.
And yoga, maybe to take it off. A lot of people responding right here. Susan in Charlottesville, Virginia. You're on the air with Claire Dieterer, author of Poser, My Life in 23 Yoga Poses. What do you think, Susan?
Hello.
Hi.
Well, I called in because, first of all, I
have experienced this in so many ways. And to tell you the truth, I think it goes all the way back to pregnancy. I think that mothers start competing for who's the most natural and who's the best and who's got the best pregnancy. And then it goes right into daycare. And I've been a full-time working mom since before my children were born. And I made a very big change that today is my very first day. I've gone part-time and gave up benefits. Thankful that my husband's nonprofit has agreed to get health insurance so that we could do that. But I have just lived that pressure from pregnancy to my 13 and 16-year-old's lives.
And where do you think that pressure comes from, Susan? Is it inside? Is it from your peers? Is it from the model of your mother before you? Maybe what didn't happen then? Where, Susan?
That's such a great question, because it's got to come from both, I suppose. I mean, there's certainly pressure on the outside, but that doesn't mean anything unless you accept it on the inside. And so this sense that we have to be perfect at everything, that good enough is not good enough, is huge. I remember feeling so guilty when I gave up breastfeeding. And it just wasn't working for us in our lives, and my daughter really wanted to eat food.
How many months? I'm sorry if it makes pressure to ask the question.
Right. How far did she make it?
Right before you failed.
By 6 months, she was eating food. She didn't.
Yeah.
But she loved breastfeeding. But, you know, I was also working full. In fact, when I first started, I was actually doing a residency. So I was pumping at night with, you know, my child at home. Somebody would spell me. I'd run home, breastfeed the baby, go back, work overnight in the hospital, pump, run home the next morning, and then try to. I mean, it was insane. But there was this oughtness to it, and of course, I wanted her to be healthy.
Yeah.
I wanted her to have the best start. But you know, I kept it a secret when I stopped. I didn't tell anybody.
Susan, you make it so great. Let me take that to Claire, if I may, in San Francisco. I mean, my gosh, you know, the oughtness of it and the breastfeeding and pumping and working and feeding and pumping and working and that pressure, you know, to have the best pregnancy, to be the most natural, to find the best, you know, where is that from, Claire?
Well, I love that she traces it back to pregnancy. I think that that's where we all first encounter this experience of all of a sudden having our business be everyone's business.
Mm-hmm. Hey, a little bump there.
Yeah, I think that was a bit of a shock. And all of a sudden, it's not about having a baby. It's about having a birth experience and a pregnancy experience. And that's a lot to deal with. And I think that does lead right into what she's talking about with the pumping and the breastfeeding and the constant sense that you ought to be doing more. I think it's really interesting that it's all stuff that does come from the natural childbirth movement. And I think that those were really great, important options for women, you know, and that it really was an amazing political movement when it rose in the 70s. Mm-hmm. It protected women from a lot of unnecessary evils of medicalized childbirth. And I'm speaking as someone who's had two C-sections.
Okay.
But I think that there's a point at which, you know, anything, the most benign thing, can become poisonous when it becomes didactic.
Mm-hmm. You must, you will. Get this down. Learn this. Do this.
Yeah, I think that's... So I do think that it comes from this very good impulse to give women more options.
But of course, I mean, you sort of take your mother to task in her generation for, in no small degree, for running off from the pig roast, hit the boat, hit the high seas, you in tow sometimes and sometimes not. But here you're going very interior. Judith Warner, you know, writes about this in the New York Times last weekend, but going very interior to find your freedom and finding it in yoga. Give us an example for those who maybe don't know the yoga mat. I mean, pick one of your poses. Take us somewhere here that helped you get away from that ultimately unbearable pressure of chasing virtue, of perfection.
Well, I think that I want to return to Susan's phrase, oughtness. Mm-hmm. That was such a great phrase.
Yeah.
And I brought a lot of oughtness to my yoga. I mean, it was part of what I called my goodness project.
Okay.
And so I wanted to advance at it. I wanted to be really good at it. I wanted to do everything perfectly. There was a lot of investment on my part in being really good at it. And I couldn't do everything perfectly. And so I do have a as I started to, you know, these ideas of what I ought to be doing closed more and more tightly around me and my family. I became more controlling. My husband became more depressed. And eventually we sort of fled the scene. We moved away with our kids to another city, to Boulder, to kind of get some space from our families and some of these pressures. And when I got there, I started to kind of unravel some of this ball of things I ought to be doing. Mm-hmm. And Susan also used another phrase I really like, which is good enough. Yeah. I started to really experiment with the idea of good enough, that what I was doing was fine and it didn't need to be great. It just needed to be okay, you know, and mm-hmm. I just needed to get the job done. Mm-hmm. So I remember in yoga, you know, at that time, for years I had been in this really volatile, hostile, super crabby relationship with the pose handstand.
With the pose. You'd already been doing yoga and a handstand.
I'd been doing yoga for about... Yeah, so this is part of
the book. I'm not sure what it means
book.
To have a super crabby relationship with hands. You got to unravel that.
I was
a
just
bit
sort of really mad at it all the time. I could do
the
it,
pose
but
itself?
I didn't. With the pose itself, a lot of the book deals with this idea that, mm-hmm. you know, yoga. When you read about yoga, it's full of talk of this really general talk of paths and intentions and destiny, and it's all very vague. But
and
when
pose
you actually
is triangle and eagle and lotus and crow and pigeon,
right?
And
they all
pose
sound
and,
so mm-hmm. mythical, right?
Oh, wonderful.
But when you actually do yoga, you're in these like long-term relationships with these actual poses,
and they you hurt, have these... or they make you feel psychologically good or bad, or they just
yes,
physically
the
hurt.
Answer... Yes, both. I mean, okay. there's some of them are physically difficult. Some of them, you know, you can't do them. You can't do splits when you first go into a yoga class. Mm-hmm. And so then you have all these feelings about that. And you,
what's wrong with you, me?
Right. And then you feel sort of dreamy about the pose. So each pose has these different emotions wrapped up in it. Mm-hmm. And I was really interested in that dynamic of yoga, that there's these poses that I was having these long conversations with over a period of years. And that kind of emotional, funny... sort of hot-headed conversation was not being reflected in the yoga books I was reading. And so I remember after I'd been doing yoga for about 8 years, mm-hmm. I was doing handstand, and I fell down. Not the first time, I might add. Mm-hmm. And in the past, you know, I would have been completely humiliated or sort of gone to the corner and tried to look serene about it all. And I remember just looking around and going, who cares? Like, no one's looking. No one cares. It's better to try to do this thing and fall down and be a mess at it, even mm-hmm. if it causes this ridiculous pratfall, than it is just to give up. And so I think that was a moment where I sort of came into contact with this idea that, you know, you don't have to be perfect. You can just try.
And there, yoga, which is always about trying, but begins to help you unravel that ball of oughtness when it comes to mothering and everything else.
Mm-hmm. That was my surprise. I had thought yoga was going to make me this good, virtuous person. And ultimately what it did was sort of bring me up against an idea that maybe being good wasn't really all that important. Maybe it wasn't the number one thing in life. You know, maybe it was more important to learn to accept things as they really are, that some ideal of how things are supposed to be is not really ultimately useful. And yoga is very, very good at bringing you up against things as they really are, whether it's your hamstrings or your vertigo when you're going into, you know, you get dizzy when you're going into a back bend, all that stuff. It's very real. And so you're sort of forced to deal with it. You can't do the ideal thing.
I can just see a lot of yogis nodding along, but also a lot of people still in the ball of oughtness saying, but what about the toxins? What about the trouble? Claire Dieter is with us. She's author of Poser, My Life in 23 Yoga Poses. Claire, we've got a lot of people, women, lining up to talk with you, and we can't wait to bring them on. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about life and marriage and babies and pressures and oughtness and yoga with Claire Dieter. Her really fine new memoir is Poser, My Life in 23 Yoga Poses. She joins us today from San Francisco, and it's about how she felt the call to perfectionism in life, in motherhood, in her 30s, happened to be in the 1990s, but it is still, and we can hear it in our callers today, still very much out there. And Claire, got lots of response here. We'll go to the phones in just a second, but also online. Here's Mari in Quincy Point, Massachusetts, says that sandbar moment you describe is now common for all mothers in the USA. She says, as hard as the previous tide of feminists fought to get their own freedoms, we found ourselves juggling all the responsibilities and very few of the rights enjoyed by our elder sisters. If yoga helps to rebalance the harried feminine units of 2011, by all means do it if you can afford to. And for everybody else, she says, you know, just eat less, sleep better, walk more, hang out. Don't just email with your kids. But here's what Amy in Suffolk, Virginia says. When my mom was mothering, kids just were. You were smart or not. You were good or not. When I became a mom in 1997, neuroscientists were telling us how important the preschool years were for mental development, the stimulation that we had to talk to our babies in our bellies, all caps. Everything about our kids' future depended on us. Wow. Let's go to New York, Canton, New York, and Sarah. Sarah, you're on with Claire Dieterer.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, how are you? I just wanted to make a point. Well, I'm a yoga teacher here in Canton and a mother of a 4-year-old and a 20-month-old. And I just wanted to make a point about the idea of striving for perfection again. And I think that this is where yoga and parenting really dovetail, because I'm always saying in my yoga classes that there's no perfect posture, and or find your own perfect posture. And I think you could take that back into your everyday life. There's no perfect parent, or be your own perfect parent. Or you could do the same with your, you know, there's no perfect way to keep house. There's no perfect anything. It's your own, you know, being true to yourself throughout that process. That's where you're really going to find all those benefits with yoga and with parenting.
But what does true to yourself mean, Sarah? Does it mean keep on breastfeeding and find the perfect wooden toy, or what the heck?
Well, it means a different thing to different people. I'm trying to night wean my 20-month-old, and it's, you know, it's been 3 nights of listening to him cry and thinking, should I get up now, or maybe is it, can we just handle midnight to 5 a.m.? And
Yep.
That's my journey, but everyone's is going to be different.
I appreciate your call, Sarah. Claire, talk to us about that. You know, trying the internal struggle over night weaning, just night weaning the 20-month-old. Wow, the pressure is on.
Yeah, I think that it's interesting in that context that you asked, what is right for you? You know, is it, how do you know? And I think that's one of the problems with the culture that moms are finding themselves in, that those ideas of how things are supposed to be are so strong that it's hard to be intuitive about what's right for you or what's right for your child or your family or for your work, too. And so I think that if we can listen to what Sarah was saying and think about what I think that yoga can help us with that, actually. I think it can help us try to be aware of how we're actually feeling at any given moment, which is surprisingly difficult given the number of things we think we ought to be doing.
Give us another example of that from the yoga world. I mean, Sarah's a yoga teacher and she's struggling with the night weaning. You had your sort of a crabby relationship with the handstand, all kinds of poses in yoga, and you framed the whole sort of passage up through those. Give us another couple of interactions with a yoga pose that helped you understand your life.
Well, there's if you talk to a lot of people who've done yoga for a long time, almost everybody has a problem with their knees. Our knees are really vulnerable. And I remember I was doing a very difficult pose called toe stand once,
okay,
where I was, you're up on your toes and you are squatting at the same time. And you're on one foot and the other foot's resting atop your knee. Hard to visualize,
okay,
I know.
Okay, I'm trying.
And
I'm working.
It's a very difficult pose. And I was squatting down into it, and my whole body was saying, don't do this. But I really wanted to do it. And, you know, of course, within seconds, my knee blew out.
Yeah.
And I think that's a perfect example where I didn't listen, and it had serious repercussions. So there's very real-life things that come up in yoga all the time where it really behooves you to listen to what's actually going on versus what mm-hmm. you think you ought to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be a very pragmatic, simple example.
No, I totally hear that one. Megan in Norfolk, Virginia. Megan, you're on the air with Claire Dieterer.
Hi. I find this discussion so fascinating, as I'm sure lots of other mothers do. I am actually in a different situation as a mom. I'm a younger mom. I had my first child at 26, almost 27, and then I had my second child, who you may actually hear, at 29, almost 30. So I'm a little bit younger, and I'm a stay-at-home mom, and I definitely see the pressures that Claire has been talking about. But I think, I don't know, in my circle of friends, I think we are better at getting rid of the oughtness and finding time for ourselves and maybe not feeling guilty about it. I think that's so important for moms, especially. So it's, I don't know, I see some of the pressures, but I think some of the moms I know that are around my age, we maybe deal with it a little differently.
I'm sure everybody does. Megan, thanks for your call. Here's one a comment online, Claire, from Monday. She says, "What's up with perfection? Not only do we romanticize cultures of the third world who wear their children out of necessity, but we expect our women here to wear their babies and entertain them. Now, if you're busy trying to live, you might wear your tyke while you ground mash between two rocks, but you won't be doing ABCs with them, I guess, in the third world." She says she and her partner are raising a baby together, crunchy as can be, but let's be realistic, whatever that means. Realistic. Please, please, huh? I got another one here going at the sort of intergenerational question. This is from CJ in Rhode Island, Claire. And she says, "The weird thing is so many of these women are patronizing in their attitude toward their female elders. They never act as if their elders might have some wisdom from both their successes and their mistakes. Their elders also had it a lot harder," she writes, "than this group, because the older women had to struggle to get access to the jobs that support these younger women so beautifully."
I'm nodding vigorously on my end.
Speak the nod.
I'll speak the nod. I deal with that very strongly in my book. I talk about this idea that our mothers and my mother made some very courageous choices to try to figure out who they were and to work. A lot of it does have to do with obtaining work rights, right? Mm-hmm. And those are things that they did for us. In the book, I say it's just another, you know, thing that they did for us, like taking care of us so that we didn't have to do it for ourselves. You know, and I wonder if they wouldn't have done those things, you know, would we have had to do them now? And so I feel like a deep appreciation and understanding of what that older generation of women did for us and for themselves. And I think that maybe one of the reasons that there can be this dismissiveness from my generation of mothers about that, first of all, there's the whole post-feminist problem of not being grateful for what you have. Mm-hmm. But then there's also the issue that people don't live near their families anymore.
Right.
Right.
Americans
all so often. It's very much the norm in America to move for your job or for your lifestyle or whatever. And many, many people don't live there where they're from. So their parents or the next generation of their family is not an important part of the discussion. And I think that also contributes to some of this insane set of standards that we experience, because we're in a bit of an echo chamber.
You would have
There's
that
no
older
one
mother
out.
Saying, "What are you doing? Let it go.
Right.
It's fine. Let it roll." But I wanted to ask you, because throughout this book, I mean, you are clearly, you say you're forgiving, and I buy that, and I read that, but you're also hyper aware of what that generation, their lives, your mother's lifestyle cost you. And it made me wonder, you know, what about what you, maybe your or your generation's hyper virtuous, at least aspiration, may cost your kids. You know, you're not running off with Larry. You're not at the pig roast, then out sailing the high seas and gone hippie style. But there's this, you know, box of oughtness. What does that cost your kids ultimately?
Well, I think that that's one of the strange mysteries of having kids, is that you never know how you're screwing them up.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so many ways. So many ways.
So that makes a sort of nice plot for life, right? Like, what's going to happen next? Mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, I think we see it a lot in the overscheduled, overcommitted child. You know, we want everything for our kids. We organize our lives as much as we can, aside from work, around their needs and what they want. And I'm seeing this more and more as my kids are older. Now they're 12 and 9. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's already been a lot of studies and writing done on how that adversely affects children. to have so many pressures on them to be the center of their family and within that context to perform. I think they end up feeling that perfectionism as well. So how can we give them a break, give ourselves right. and give them a break?
And end up pulling them into the box as well. Here's a comment from Carla in Boston who says, what timing? Just yesterday, I wrote a blog post declaring my mantra, speaking of yoga, for the year, and it is no rules, exclamation mark. I'm the mother of two under three, and I wrote, I'm not going to remain beholden to the rules of those who don't know me or my family. Go ahead, talk to me about sleep training, nursing, dinner time, discipline, daycare, preschool, whatever. I'll listen, and I might agree or I might not. But either way, I'm not going to beat myself up about it anymore.
That's great.
Carla's freedom, liberation mantra. Michelle in Northborough, Massachusetts. Michelle, you're on the air with Claire Dieter.
Hi. I am very excited about this discussion today because, again, I feel like you're telling my story. I'm from the same generation, born in 1970, and I have a three-year-old child. I felt the intense pressure of the, you know, breastfeeding on demand, exclusively wearing the baby, and I feel that it truly exacerbated my postpartum depression to where I was very focused on the baby, had no time to myself, and essentially, you know, my marriage suffered and I suffered. And if I ever have a second child, there is no way that I will go through that first year the same way that I did with my first child.
You're sure? You're strong enough, Michelle. You've got the fortitude now to say, no, I don't have to be all that, exactly that?
Yeah. I mean, it was because trying to be all that ended up being horrible. I mean, I was trying to do the best thing for my child, and really, my world just, you know, it was destroyed. So, no, I would not do it a second time.
Michelle, you're on the same path. Claire, you write about being sort of terrified by this arena you found yourself suddenly in the middle of.
Well, and I did. I was sort of so thrown off guard by it. And I also want to talk about something Michelle said about her marriage suffering.
Oh, yeah.
You know, a lot of this book deals with a very dark place I ended up in my marriage. As I was going through these experiences
with
parenting, my husband, Bruce, was really spiraling into a depression. And I write about that in the book, and he very kindly and courageously let me write about his experience. But one thing that's really surprised me as the book has gone out in the world and people are responding to it is how many women say their husbands are depressed. And there seems to be a real lineup between the experience of the moms having these intense pressures being put on them and the dads who feel disempowered because they can't quite do anything right because the moms are so controlling.
Hyper-virtuous controlling, yeah, okay.
Yeah, and the dad's becoming quite depressed. That's a story I'm hearing over and over, and I do think it affects our marriages and our sense of being partners.
Can you yoga your way out of that one?
Well, I think that the thing that really helped it was what actually yoga did help me with, which was that letting go of the control, not trying to make everything perfect, because I was trying to fix my husband all the time and tell everyone the right way they ought to be. And God, that would depress anyone.
Get your posture right. Get your life right. Get every little angle of it right. Give us another yogic moment here. I mean, it's part of what makes this unique. And so many people are on those mats these days. As you came along in the arc of this journey toward wherever you ended up, I don't know, what pose got you to that, wherever you are now?
Well, it really was it's really a gradual journey. And I think that's one thing this book deals with is that, you know, most of us don't get to go off and have spectacular spiritual experiences.
Retreats. It would be nice.
Retreats, right. Mm-hmm. It would be really nice. It would be great. But most of us are sort of trying to muddle through. And, you know, like people are saying, it's expensive to go to yoga. So you're paying for yoga class and you're trying to go to work. And we're trying to get better about this stuff in our regular day-to-day lives. So there's not a lot of gigantic aha moments in this experience. There's sort of an accumulation of small moments. But I remember I had a teacher who was teaching me wheel, which is another way for name for a full back bend, mm-hmm. which is, you know, the pose that gymnasts do when they're like six.
Where your feet are on the ground, then you're bent all the way over with your tummy toward the sky and your hands on the ground behind you.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Well described. Okay. And my teacher was talking about this idea that she was a hunchy person. So we're trying to do the pose and she's yakking away. Mm-hmm. And she's talking about how she hunches her shoulders all the time mm-hmm. and how she thought yoga was going to cure her from being such a hunched up person. And the longer she did it, her shoulders never improved. She kept hunching except for that 1 hour a day when she was in yoga.
Yeah.
And it was this, she sort of was talking about this idea that we don't need to be getting better. We don't need to be improving or using yoga to sort of become higher, better people. We can just enjoy it and enjoy its benefits for that hour that we're in the room. And I feel like that's an idea that's really applicable to a lot of life. We don't have to constantly be leveraging our experiences to get somewhere. We can just be doing it and enjoying it at the moment.
Talk about freedom. There's a real freedom simply in that insight right there. If that's all you get from years of yoga, that's a pretty powerful one.
I think that was her thought as well.
Claire Dieter, I wish we had more time. It's just a whole lot of fun and kind of important at the same time to talk with you about this. I appreciate the new book. It was beautifully written and well put together. Thanks so much for joining us today, Claire.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Claire Dieter, her new memoir is Poser, My Life in 23 Yoga Poses. We'll go out with a little more. We just can't resist it. Here's Yoga Trance Dance from Shiva Ray. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Ping Wong, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsunas, Hillary McQuilkin, James Ross, Marika Spence, and John Wibby. Our senior producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us, and good luck out there. This is On Point.
In this meditation, you are dancing over anything that binds you. If you feel any stiffness or rigidity in your physical body, then as you move, liberate your creative freedom. Feel the power of your expression.